Well, hi, everybody. It's the Monday before Thanksgiving. I'm Larry Jacobs, November 20th, and we have a wonderful show for you today. Thanks to my friends at Smart Preach over at all those curated newsletters at smartpreach.com. And they do great stuff in education, and they check to see the best bloggers out there. And we do a couple of shows every month with those particular groups. And today, Scott McCloud is an associate professor of educational leadership at the University of Colorado in Denver is my guest. He's going to talk about different schools for a different world, his book, Six Arguments for Why Schools Need to Be Different. And I have to say that while Dr. McCloud is an absolute expert in educational technology, he forgot the last email I sent him a week or so ago about the call-in numbers, but we got him on because we were able to straighten it out at the last minute. Okay, I want to bring Scott on right now. Hi, Scott. It's Larry.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
Yes. I'm fine. No, I sent you an email a couple of weeks ago, gave you the new number, and you said that's perfect. But I that email got lost. That's why you were going through all that agita before the show started.
Oh, yeah, I had that, but I didn't catch the new number. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. I forgive thee. All right. And it's great to have you here, my friend. It really, really is. McCloud, you're not the Highlander. You don't live forever, do you?
No, but that would be fun.
It might be, or then again, it might not be. We will find out. I got to thank my friends over at smartbrief.com. They do curated news in every area of industry you could imagine, and one of those industries is education. And Melissa Greenwood, their incredible editor, searches the internet, spends all her time searching the internet to find the best bloggers out there. And besides Scott being a well-respected professor and the winner of the Outstanding Leadership Award from ISTE in 2016. He's a terrific blogger and an author, and we're going to talk about his book today. So smartbrief.com/industry/education will get you there. And if you're posting out there, maybe we'll get you on the show. Melissa is the one who picks you out. Don't blame me, and it's her. It was Melissa, not me, Scott.
Sounds good.
My beautiful friend, Melissa. Okay, and happy Thanksgiving. It's the week of Thanksgiving.
Yes, thank you. You too.
Thank you, my friend. Okay, I love the title of your book, Different Schools for a Different World. Boy, that's like so important. It's incredible. Six arguments for why schools need to be different. We've got time today. Okay, so are you ready, Dr. McCloud?
I'm ready. Let's roll.
Give me six arguments why schools need to be different.
Okay, so short list.
Yes.
Dean and I try to highlight six key relevance gaps that we see between schools and the society that surrounds them. I think, you know, what we see is that the world is changing pretty quickly. Schools are struggling to keep up. So if you think about the rate of change for society is going up pretty steeply. The rate of change for schools is going less so. That space in between is what we might call a relevance gap. And those relevance gaps continue to grow rather than shrink. So we talk about
how far behind,
information.
Scott? How far behind? Is there a measure? How far behind society?
No, there's not a measure,
schools.
But we're not keeping up.
Okay. I knew that.
So the first gap is one around information literacy, right? We have a brand new information landscape. It's been developing over the last few. Rather than being ink on paper, it's digital bits in the ether connected by mobile devices and online environments. And that new information landscape has a number of characteristics that are quite different from our old ink on paper printed book world. And if you look at most schools around the world, they're struggling to figure out how to prepare kids for that new information landscape rather than the old one. So we get into all kinds of interesting questions around participation and consumption and validity and reliability and how do you produce and create in this new space as opposed to the old space. And so lots of big gaps in that information literacy place. So that's argument one. Argument two is around economic and workforce preparation, right? Like I don't want schools to just be turning out worker bees for corporations,
right.
But I also recognize that people need to make a living and raise a family and, you know, things like that. And we're hearing over and over again.
Well, you know,
again,
I got to stop you.
Yeah.
You know, schools, as you well know, okay, were designed to create a workforce. okay, for General Motors and Carnegie Steel and whoever you want to talk about. All right, so there's nothing wrong with creating a workforce. I don't think you meant that, okay? But we also need thinkers, I think, is what you also mean, too.
Yes, absolutely. So, and what we're hearing over and over again from not only our universities but also our employers is that we need folks who are graduates who are much more adept at those what we might call deeper learning skills or higher level thinking skills like critical thinking and problem solving, powerful creativity, communication, collaboration, empathy, global awareness, all that stuff that typically was reserved for a small slice of our graduates, maybe 15-20%, the ones that went on to college. And now we have to go much deeper into the graduate pool to gain those skills. So that's gap number two.
Wow.
Argument number three is really around learning. You know, these new tools create unbelievable opportunities for kids to do interesting and amazing things. And schools are hesitant and fearful rather than embracing the powerful learning that could occur. And so whether that's the inability to give kids access or whether it's the unwillingness to let kids fly and have wings with these tools, even when we do have the devices, we're not tapping into the power of these tools in any way. So what we're often finding is that kids learning at home is more robust than it is at school, which is sort of an interesting phenomenon, right? Fourth argument is really around boredom. We've known for centuries that kids are bored out of their mind in school. And we seem to have very little willingness to do anything about it. So we lose a tremendous number of students. You know, I think dropout rate is still hovering around 20-25% in many places, often higher in urban districts. Even the kids that don't physically drop out have mentally checked out. You know, the Gallup poll shows us that we're lucky if in high school a third of our students say they're engaged in learning. The other two-thirds say no. So that's a tremendous gap. And to be honest, a lot of wasted human potential.
Well, it sure is, and I just have to comment on that. I've been always been thinking about I spent my 12 years in Philadelphia public schools and probably learned, although I spent all 12, okay, I probably learned what I needed to know or what I thought I needed to know in six of them. I'm not saying one through six, but if you just, you know what I mean? Yeah, about half, 50%. Yeah. And I've always wondered, okay, why we do the other 50%? I know it's strange. And of course, if they're bored, where do they go to work if they think they're bored now?
Right. Well, but maybe part of that is because we don't have very good mechanisms of identifying students' skills and talents and interests and passions, and then figuring out how to tap into those not only in school but how to channel them to the right work paths. So we have a lot of mismatches, I think, between students and work career paths, and we don't do a very good job in K-12 of helping kids get aligned.
Okay.
Let's see, two more arguments to go. The fifth one is around equity.
Equity,
so a lot of kids from getting left behind. So even when we do create opportunities in school for kids to think and create and make and do and contribute and do those higher level work that may be more intellectually stimulating and personally fulfilling, what we find most often is that, of course, it's the white middle class kids that get those opportunities most often. And we take our poor kids of color and put them in remedial opportunities instead of understanding that they need something different to catch them and move them forward. So those gaps continue to increase.
That's increasing. Are you saying that the equity issue, the challenge is increasing, not decreasing?
I think so, because we're so focused on getting kids above the line on these standardized bubble tests that we double down on drill and kill and remediation rather than reclaiming kids by giving them something different, a different kind of learning modality. So we just give them more of the stuff they already hate.
No wonder they're bored.
So that's right, exactly. Right. And then the last gap we just talked about is what we call an innovation gap. It's just the inability of schools to move faster, and it's just that simple. It's this idea that while other entities are ramping up and figuring out how to be more adaptive and more responsive, schools are plodding along pretty slowly. And to be honest, so are universities. So those are the six.
I would agree.
Arguments.
Okay. You know, it's interesting of the two things, of the six things you mentioned just today. I did two shows before this one, and they both of the things, kids being fearful, okay, of school learning, et cetera, and the teachers taking care of that and moving forward. And Charlotte Mecklenburg, I did a show with them. It was wonderful. We talked about personalized learning today. But their challenges, okay, that they have 170 schools in the district. They move towards personalized learning. Only 63 of the schools are involved. Okay, there's a hesitancy somewhere. Okay, and it's not coming from the top. It's coming from the schools. All right.
Absolutely.
And, it's just wild. The other show I did, which was at 9 a.m. this morning, was about social justice because the report was focused on it in Miami-Dade schools. All right. And that has to do with the equity issue. There's so much overhanging discipline in the school. The need to have a disciplined environment, that kids are being suspended and all that sort of thing, and they're not meeting the equity needs. These kids come from these, in many cases, bad neighborhoods. Okay, and then they bring in a million dogs to sniff for drugs, but kids see the dogs, in the neighborhood. They know that those dogs can be very vicious. They don't see them as a good thing, which scares the hell out of the kids, okay, which doesn't make for a good learning environment, and that's an equity thing. Okay, we got to understand that backwards and forwards, and it's so amazing. I listen to you when I talk to superintendents, and I talk to superintendents a lot. They're all trying, okay, and the teachers, they tell me, are trying to really make these things happen. But in your, I'll call it, if I may, your perch above as a professor of educational leadership, and you see this from a different angle. All right. The problem is it's not happening. In your thought, it's not happening. Now, it is happening, but it's happening so slowly, to go back to, that gap between what's out there and what needs to be done. And I'm curious, how do you even start curing this kind of thing? And, you talk about all this personalized learning and stuff. Teachers are in a profession where many of them, most of them have tenure, okay? It's not the real world. And we're asking teachers, and I love teachers, do not misunderstand that, okay? But it's not the real world, okay? You're preparing kids for the real world. Very few of them are going to become teachers. And they can be fired, they can be this, they can be that. And I don't mean to get into a whole big deal about this, but it's a challenge of making sure that the people who are teaching them to enter the real world really understand it, the world of work these days, the world of business. That was my spiel for today. Can I lecture at your class?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks.
Right, so we got all kinds. So we have all kinds of things going on there. One is the urgency or felt need for change by a superintendent or principal, for example, may not be matched by the folks on the front lines in the classrooms. And so until we have not only shared understandings, but also shared commitments to doing this work, what we will see is we'll just see isolated pockets of innovation. A classroom teacher here or there who's doing interesting things, a school who are there who's, popping up and trying something new. But we don't see that sort of whole scale systems change. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. But the challenge, and I know you're not holding anyone per se responsible, okay?
Yeah.
But the challenge is bureaucracy. School districts are a bureaucracy, that's A. And B, they depend on public money. Okay, that's where the money comes from. They don't produce something you sell at the school store and make $6 billion a year. Okay? The money comes from the public. And a lot of these things, I think, can be corrected if the public and the politicians put money against it. But then the old argument is, well, they throw money against it and nothing changes. Okay, I'm arguing against myself here. All right, which brings back to what you do, which is educational leadership.
Right. So
you teach that
a lot. Yes, no, absolutely. Right. And I'm always focusing on the leaders because they're the ones who are in charge of the systems. If we want systemic change to happen, we have to hit the people in charge of them. But you know, a lot of this is mindset. A lot of this is mindset and then putting in appropriate support structures. And I would argue that even in many districts that say they're trying to do this, their support structures are crappy. They think a 1 or 2 hour PD blocks are going to result in the full scale transformation. You know, there's
right.
little follow up. There's lack of IT support. There's no opportunity for teachers to collaborate with each other to figure this out and you know, engage in collective expertise and experience sharing. I mean, you know, we've got policies that get in the way, right? We, you know, have these acceptable use policies that are in place that even though we put devices in the hands of every kid, work really hard to prevent kids from using them. You know, like there's all this stuff that's happening that's under the bailiwick of the leadership that they're just not making happen in ways that are productive.
Why?
And none of that, well, none of that has anything
Why?
To do with money. It just has to, well, it's a great question, right? I mean, obviously schools are complex organizations, but something's going on here where we as leaders can't figure out how to create the necessary support structures to move. You know, and so let's take something simple, like professional development, professional learning of our teachers, right? Like
okay.
we know that one and done events aren't impactful. And we know yeah. that
I'm laughing because I know how right you are. Yeah.
Right, right. And the once a month
yeah.
or once a week early release or late start or after school, whatever, isn't impactful, particularly when it's not even on a sustained topic over time, but every week is something new and different. And yet we continue to do it that way, right? And we've had how many decades now of knowledge from Learning Forward and other organizations about what effective professional learning looks like, and yet we can't seem to implement it. Now, whose
Why?
Fault is that?
Why? Well, yeah, what are we doing wrong? That's a good question.
Right.
What are we doing? I mean,
right?
I got my hands in the air now. Like, why? We always have these discussions. Why? Why
right.
can't we move
right.
forward? What's the problem
I don't
here?
Know. Right. Well, I think part of it comes back to the Peter Senge. The fact that we're not.
Wait a minute, I'm getting an echo. Just say that again. Something's going on.
Oh, I just said that, you know, if you go back to Peter Senge and his work, you know, we're not really learning organizations. You know, we don't seem to have the ability to learn and grow, at least at the rate of change that we need to. You know, I mean, we've been doing bad PD for decade after decade after decade. And there's other schools that do it well and do it right and have figured out how to change their schedules around to give teachers more time to interact and collaborate. And for whatever reason, we're not willing to learn from them. We're not willing to implement, you know, it's hard to say exactly why, because it's always locally contextual. Every school is its own unique whatever. But if you look across the broad scale, we're not getting it done.
Well, it is just brutal. Okay. And there's so many things. Are you satisfied, Scott, as you must look at districts all over the country, are there any districts out there that have made these changes, I'll call them that, that you're recommending, or seen these gaps and really made a difference? Like, what's your favorite school district in the world? Maybe that's the way to answer that question.
Probably Albemarle County in Virginia, which is around Charlottesville.
Nice.
Because Pam Moran is the superintendent there, and she's amazing. But, you know, whole scale across the entire district, very hard to identify places that are doing good stuff. Maybe St. Rain here in Colorado is doing some interesting things. But
mm-hmm.
we see more, I think, at the school level right now rather than at the district level.
Oh, okay.
Where we see a lot of schools that are doing some interesting stuff. And maybe that's the smaller unit. It's small enough that if a principal gets fired up and has the ability to work with his or her educators, they can make some cool stuff happen within the building.
I think they can. When you talk to your students who are all going to be superintendents and principals and all that, that's what you teach.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. What yep. do they say? You say these same things to them. They're in the trenches every day. Okay. And they you know, obviously they want to make changes, etc. What do they say when you talk to them about these things?
They say that they feel constrained and helpless in the face of inadequate leadership by their own principals.
Wow. Is that a standard?
Yeah, it's pretty standard.
That's scary. That's scary. Well, so they want to become principals themselves to affect change, is what I'm reading into that.
Yes, and you know, the principalship may be one of the most thankful, complex jobs in the world, right? It's classic middle manager job. And there's a lot of moving parts to that position. And I think a lot of people just struggle to juggle all the parts effectively, right? So things fall apart. And so, you know, you're attending to a parent complaint over here or the latest disciplinary action with the kid over there. And meanwhile, And meanwhile, you're not paying attention to professional learning that's coming up next week or, you know, deep, rich curriculum conversations that would move us in a different direction. I mean, there's a lot of moving from putting out fire to putting out fire.
So what do you teach? So you're a professor of educational leadership, again, at University of Colorado in Denver. So what are you teaching them? And I'm going to ask an odd question here, because you just said the word classic middle manager. Okay. are you taking some things from the business school? Okay. And putting them into education. What are you teaching them so that they can affect change? And I mean that dead serious.
Absolutely. So we talk a good game in a leadership about trying to facilitate change and about trying to focus on the things that are important and to try and align support systems and other structures and strategic ways to make it work. But I don't think we do a good job of giving our prospective principals really concrete techniques and strategies to make that happen. You know, we have these principal licensure standards that are a mile wide. And so there's always pressure to cover all those, just like teachers have pressure to cover content in their own classes. And I don't think we have the ability to really focus in on what would a really strategic, targeted principal prep program look like that was designed to create change agents. I think we're mostly still designed to create managers of the system. And that's not true just in my university. That's probably true almost everywhere. So lessons learned from the business school and other places that are nimble and more adaptive, very few.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm quite serious about this. So you recognize all these things. I know you do. And I know a lot of other professors, et cetera, recognize it as well. Okay. But isn't it up to you folks to put this into their minds and make things happen and I don't mean to be derogatory and lead by example, like make that change. We'll use your school at the University of Colorado Denver and show that it can be done. Okay, to these to the folks who want to be principals, because they're going to have to get it done.
Yes. Absolutely.
Not to lay and any guilt on you. That's not my point. I'm not. You know what I mean?
Nope. Lay it on.
I'm just curious about it.
No, absolutely.
I don't mean to.
Yes, no, absolutely.
I don't mean to. Seriously.
Lay it on. And I think that we need to own greater responsibility for all of this, right? Like, we continue to churn out new principals and new superintendents who aren't equipped to do much of the work that we really need them to do.
Bingo.
Part of that is lack
and
of background.
You can't be happy with that.
No. Like, let me give you an example. So there are 600 educational leadership programs across the country. There's at least 3,000 ed leadership faculty. The number of faculty across the country that even care about technology and schools is probably 10. So in a world where technology is transforming everything, 99% of the ed leadership programs across the country continue to pour out new generations of school leaders that have no exposure to this stuff whatsoever.
I could ask my famous question, why, again, but that's absolutely unbelievable. I've been saying for years, and you must know AACTE, the American Association of Colleges and Teachers. I work with them a lot, okay, and I love having the various deans on the show and all that. I think the world of most of them. In fact, all of them I've talked to, I think they're terrific. But what I always ask them, in a world where, like you said, there's supposed to be innovation in the K-12 classroom, are your professors still lecturing, or are they using those innovations in their classes to lead by example so that the students I mean, if a doctor went to a medical school and the doctor was teaching him, instead of using an X-ray machine, use the Brownie camera, you'd have concerns.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Absolutely.
You got to lead by, you know, you got to teach by example. And that's the thing that scares me about what's going on out there, and you just confirmed that from your knowledge of it. You know, people use the word, and you won the award for MISTI, okay? People use the word education technology. And I keep saying you can drop the technology word because education is technology these days. You don't need it's not two separate things. You don't need one to be the adjective for the noun. Okay, that's education. It's technology. Okay, that's simple. It's unbelievable. When you see these things, you're an ISTE award winner. Now you're a Smart Brief award winner. You're made famous now for being here on the show. What do you? I mean, you must be going nuts. Makes me crazy to talk about it.
I go nuts on a regular basis. You know, you mentioned AACTE. I had a very similar
and
conversation.
You're going to, and
with,
McLeod, you're going to live forever. It's not good to be so crazy for so long.
Right? I had a very similar conversation with the Iowa affiliate, the IACTE. And, you know, there's like 35 teacher prep programs there. And, you know, I just kept showing them stuff like standards-based grading and competency-based progressions. We talked about rich tech infusion. We talked about problem-based learning. You know, we talked about one-to-one initiatives. You know, and again, I just kept asking the same question. Is this part of your program? Do your graduates know how to do this? Do you know how to do this? And the answers over and over again were no, 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 no. They just don't have the background. They don't have the professional background and experience and expertise to do it.
But that can't be an excuse anymore, Scott. It really can't. I mean, we're well into the 21st century.
No,
it
can't
agree. Be an excuse.
I agree, but we're not doing,
I know you do.
Right, but we're not doing a good job of bringing in those outside partners that could fill in the holes that we have. Right, because maybe we as a school leadership faculty at our local university don't have the expertise to talk about technology-fueled innovation, for example. But you know what? We've got outside practitioner partners in school districts who do. And we've got potential corporate partners who do. We've got people in the nonprofit sector who could really inform some stuff. We just never bring them in. At least not enough.
I keep asking you the question, why? And it's so crazy.
Right.
Okay,
Right. Because I think both schools and universities are still pretty insular.
They got to get uninsular. They can't be in a bubble. It's that simple.
Agreed.
They can't be
Absolutely
in a bubble.
Agreed.
You know, it's unbelievable. I just want to talk to you for a second, just to change the story for a second. I mean, I actually didn't mean to do this, but I mentioned the word bubble. Okay? Sorry. Okay? Your blog post is dangerouslyirrelevant.org. I must have spelled it wrong before.
Correct.
Oh, I put .com. That's why it's .org. Dangerouslyirrelevant.org. Forgive me. Technology, leadership, and the future of schools. You should go here. And the article that you actually won this award for from Smart Brief, how school leaders can combat filter bubbles and fake news in this day and age.
Right.
Okay. And let's talk about bubbles for a second, okay, and media literacy.
Okay.
How good are we on this? And how good are the school leaders on this?
So the latest research has come out from Stanford, and it's really dismaying. It shows us that huge numbers of students and graduates have very low ability to discern reliability and validity of online sources, and that they're basically just chumps waiting to happen for whatever messages get shoved in front of them.
Yeah.
You know, the
Dos Vitania, comrades. Don't Dos Vitania, vote for so-and-so.
But, you know, other than a librarian or media specialist who hopefully is up to date on the latest mechanisms for determining information reliability on the web, you know, there isn't anybody else at the school who really is trained in that area. And so then you take a bunch of classroom teachers and building level principals whose ability to do this stuff themselves is highly variable, right? And you've got a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, you do.
You know,
and actually,
do
it's interesting.
60-70% of the adults don't know how to do this stuff.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting. My wife was out at the National Council for the Social Studies conference. She just got back today, as a matter of fact, in CSS. She had a great time. And one of the things she went to was a long, I think it might have been a day-long discussion on this, media literacy. All right. And you just mentioned something interesting I hadn't thought of. You know, that we always think of the librarian. Okay. And they're wonderful. I love school librarians. The librarian. All right. As the media specialist, the one who's going to teach digital literacy. But, you know, we've got a civics problem, and this literacy, media literacy carries over into civics, as we have all learned. Okay. And I'm curious, you know, has anybody talked about training social studies teachers to be the media literacy specialist? Which kind of makes sense in my head.
No, absolutely. We do have, and I'm a former social studies teacher. I totally get that.
Well, me too.
I think social studies teachers are in their game. I think they're constrained by curriculum coverage pressures. And I think even more importantly, they're constrained by political concerns and the fear of controversy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So in other words, in order to really become information fluent these days, you're going to have to look at some controversial topics and how they're addressed on the web from both sides. And schools are notoriously controversy averse. So what happens is it all just gets shut down in the name of controversy avoidance or conflict avoidance. And then we just get shoveled back into our dry, boring social studies textbooks.
Right.
Which
so what's going to happen
to avoid all controversy?
Right. So what's going to happen? You know, you talked about how school leaders can combat filter bubbles and fake news. We got to take that risk. We can't be scared, okay, to do that. And like I say, we see the cost. Are you familiar with the website called procon.org?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, they're good friends, Commie over there. And not communist, that's his name, Commie. And I always kid him about that. Okay, but the fact, the fact of the matter is, we have to take these things on, and if we're going to take them on, social studies teachers, I think, would be good ones to do it. And you know, you have to worry about being controversial. You can talk both sides of an issue, okay, without getting into a fist fight. I hope, you know, it's just amazing, Scott. I could talk about this stuff for hours. We got to go. This is you're incredible. I love talking to you. Right.
Thanks.
Come back on.
Terry,
will you come back on?
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. Sure. Of course.
Did you have fun?
I did. Always. It's always fun talking with you.
Thank you, my friend. And did you, and you're not the guy from Highlander, McLeod. Not Angus. What the hell was his name? Angus McLeod. What the hell was his name? I can't even remember.
Connor.
Okay. Connor. Connor McLeod. Right. Right. Okay. But you're not him. Just want to make sure.
Not yet, at least.
Not yet. I hope you live forever, but you're going to have a lot of aggravation unless we get the stuff straightened out. You might be better off dead, Devin, I'm thinking about it, but we're gonna keep going. I love this conversation. I'll be in touch with you, Scott. Okay, thanks a million, my friend. Yes, go ahead, please.
That's new for interview. That's new for interview. You're interrupted.
Wait, I can't hear you. You echoed back. Say it again.
Oh, that's a new interview. To be told you're better off dead.
There you go. Okay, I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Scott.
Sounds
good, buddy.
Thanks, Larry. Bye.
Yeah. Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye. Right? Scott McLeod, everybody, not the Highlander. Okay, he tweets at McLeod, McLeod. All right, and, I go on for this for hours. He's got me going here. All right, we'll archive the show, education-talkradio.org. Tweet it out at Edu Talk Radio. I like this guy. Okay, I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Free K-12 Education Talk Radio. We'll be back tomorrow with 3 shows. Have a good day. And thank you, SmartBrief. SmartBrief.com. SmartBrief.com/industry/education. Sign up for some free newsletters. Great stuff. All curated news. A million subjects.